This latest reaction of Pyongyang does make me feel like that looks a little bit more troublesome and as if it won't happen.
North Korea voices opposition to new sanctions. It's Tuesday, December 18th. This is VOA Asia. Hello and welcome. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You'll find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Myanmar women are being trafficked to China. Australia sharpens its Middle East policy. Saffron is suffering in Kashmir. Cats learning from people. Holidays at the White House. It's all on today's VOA Asia. North Korea has turned up the rhetoric heat, criticizing the latest U.S. sanctions targeting three North Koreans for rights abuses. The foreign ministry expressed its shock and indignation and accused the United States of being bent on bringing relations back to the status of last year, which was marked by exchanges of fire. It warned further such sanctions would block the path to denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula forever. Washington last week announced that three North Korean officials, including a close aide to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un, were being sanctioned over rights abuses and censorship. The sanctions involve asset freezes covered by U.S. jurisdiction and a ban on transactions with the Americans. Harry Kazianis, director of defense studies at the Center for the National Interest, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the prospect of another U.S.-North Korean summit appears uncertain for the time being.
On the one hand, you have North Korea making sort of veiled threats once again, which is one of the reasons the Trump administration got very upset with North Korea. It was actually one of the reasons they canceled the Trump-Kim summit before we eventually had that in Singapore. So I think the North Koreans need to be very careful here. But at the same time, you have other situations that actually make me feel that things are going really well. We've had a number of South Korean-North Korean initiatives, so, you know, taking apart mines, whole sections of minefields, working to demilitarize the actual demilitarized zone. So there has been some good inter-Korean progress. At the same time, Kim Jong-un did not make his visit to Seoul, which he was supposed to do really in the last 2 weeks. So reading the tea leaves on North Korea right now is very, very hard. There's a lot of good and a lot of bad, and usually at the end of the day, that usually doesn't bode well.
On Friday, President Trump indicated he's in no hurry for the denuclearization of North Korea.
That sounds like President Obama's strategic patience policy. And it's funny because that was one of the things that Donald Trump was very angry at and did not like that policy. But it almost feels like very, very surely and very slowly we're almost moving back to that same posture with North Korea. The United States doesn't seem like it's in a hurry to offer a lot of concessions to Pyongyang. At the same time, Pyongyang doesn't feel like they want to offer a lot of concessions to Washington. And it almost feels like we're going back to where we were back in, you know, 2011, 2012, where no sides were talking, but at the same time, the North Korean nuclear threat keeps getting worse and worse. They're able to build more missiles, more nuclear warheads, and that itself is concerning.
There's been much talk about a possible second U.S.-North Korea summit, but the two sides have yet to even to reschedule working-level talks.
Yeah, that is concerning. I mean, this latest reaction of Pyongyang does make me feel like that looks a little bit more troublesome and as if it won't happen. I think the real point for having a summit is there would need to be some sort of leap forward. Both sides would have to be willing to give something. At the end of the third inter-Korean summit with President Moon and Kim Jong-un, Kim Jong-un had offered essentially either inspections of the closing of the Yongbyon nuclear facility in exchange for what he called for as corresponding measures. Now, a lot of people at the time in Seoul were saying that that was either sanctions relief or some sort of end-of-war declaration. I think that could be the thing that Kim Jong-un and Donald Trump get together on to have the summit. But the most important thing at all here is we cannot expect this to be fixed in days, months, even years. Both sides have to build trust in order to make bigger concessions. So it's a little disingenuous to have these big summits and have these good leader-to-leader talks when the working-level folks aren't getting together, because it's at those working-level discussions that you're going to actually have the agreements.
The South Korean news agency Yonhap reports U.S. Special Representative on North Korea Policy Stephen Biegun will visit Seoul this week to find ways to salvage the denuclearization process. No meaningful discussions have taken place since U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visited Pyongyang October 7th. A meeting between Pompeo and his North Korean counterpart Kim Jong-chol in New York on November 8th was postponed. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Malaysia charges Goldman Sachs 2 employees in 1MDB probe. Chinese get chances to invest in Vietnam despite political rifts. U.S. and China trade barbs at WTO amid calls for reform. Ottawa's ambassador meets with second Canadian citizen arrested in China. Nissan board meets, no chairman picked. Expanded coverage of these stories and more can be found on Facebook at VOA Asia. You'll also find quite a bit on the voanews.com website. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Thousands of women and girls are being trafficked from Myanmar to China and forced to marry and bear children. That's the finding of research led by the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health and the Kachin Women's Association of Thailand. VOA's Asia's Ira Melman spoke via Skype with Cortland Robinson, associate professor at the Bloomberg School and the report's lead author. Dr. Robinson was asked if the report held many surprises.
I think we were surprised at the proportion of women, roughly 40% of those we interviewed who had been married to a Chinese man were currently or formerly married within the last 5 years, experienced forced marriage, and a smaller percentage, about 23%, I believe, experienced trafficking into forced marriage, which involved some kind of deceit in the context of being recruited into a marriage or transported or harbored in the context of moving into China or being somehow deceived into a marriage that they did not understand the full kind of dimensions of. I would also add that we found whether in forced marriage or not, but more particularly in a context of forced marriage, quite high rates of intimate partner violence, controlling behavior, physical and sexual violence, and psychological abuse. So all of these tell a story of real vulnerability.
Do you have numbers to tell us how major a problem this is, aside from each individual situation?
We have estimated that there are approximately 10,000 or so women in China currently living just within one area in Yunnan province who, by our estimations, are either now or have been within the last 5 years a victim of forced marriage. And over the last 5 years, about 7,500 or so women have returned from China and are living in Tianjin State or Northern Shan State who have experienced forced marriage sometime in the last 5 years and returned. Now, there's a subset of that who've experienced forced childbearing. So about 80% of the women in a forced marriage have had a child. So that was one of the clear drivers of the arrangement, that people in China, particularly men who are not, if you will, competitive in the marriage market, they may be poorer, more rural, lower education, lower income, maybe older, maybe have other issues, simply are not available to obtain a bride in the ordinary context of going out and meeting someone and being seen as a good match because of the quite significant male-female sex ratio imbalance, about 120 males per 100 females on average across the sort of at the national level.
What about the China's one-child policy? How did this contribute to this, if it did?
Given strong, what is called in demographic circles, son preference. That is to say, if you're going to have one child, there's a strong preference that that child be a boy. So you end up with more boys and girls being married. Now, the one-child policy has been sort of voided, declared null and void. That may change the dynamics over time. There is some evidence to suggest that's already happening, but it's certainly too late for a lot of older males who don't have the means by which to, as I said, sort of negotiate a bride, and hence you have this market for foreign brides, ethnic minorities, people coming in without documents, all of whom are much more exploitable into these kinds of conditions of force and often abuse.
The report makes several recommendations to reduce forced marriages in the region. Among them, the government of Myanmar should institute policies to protect Myanmar residents and would-be migrants through the issuance of personal identification documents that would provide them with proof of citizenship and nationality and enable them to obtain travel passes and work authorization in China. And that the Chinese government should allow women, girls, men, and boys fleeing the conflict in Myanmar to access safe refuge and humanitarian aid in China, thereby reducing their vulnerability and being exploited and trafficked. Happening now in Asia, the wives of four China's most prominent rights lawyers and activists shaved their heads Monday in protest over what they called the persecution of their husbands by the government. Find the latest developments for this story and more online by watching VOA 60. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad, as always, to have you with us on VOA Asia. Australia will recognize West Jerusalem as the capital of Israel, but will not immediately move its embassy from Tel Aviv. Prime Minister Scott Morrison will also acknowledge the aspirations of Palestinians for a future state with its capital in East Jerusalem. We hear more from Phil Mercer in Sydney.
Australia says it won't be moving its embassy in Israel to Jerusalem, but could do so in the future if the city's status is finalised under a peace settlement. In October, Prime Minister Scott Morrison said he found arguments in favour of moving Australia's diplomatic presence from Tel Aviv to be persuasive. He denied his comments were an attempt to influence Jewish voters in a crucial by-election in Sydney. There was support from the Israeli government, but Palestinian leaders said Australia risked becoming an international pariah. A major trade deal between Australia and neighbouring Indonesia, which has the world's largest Muslim population, has also been jeopardised because of speculation Canberra could move its embassy to Jerusalem. The decision not to relocate the Australian embassy should ease some of that diplomatic pressure, according to Daniel Flitton, managing editor of the Lowy Institute's Interpreter, a magazine produced by the Sydney-based think tank.
That really depends on the reaction from the rest of the world as to whether or not this issue continues to dog the government. There's a difference between when a United States makes this decision and the rest of the world reacts, because the United States is a big power, versus when Australia makes this decision. And there is a risk that some countries might choose to try and make Australia an example and try and punish Australia as a consequence.
Last December, President Donald Trump overturned decades of US neutrality when he recognised the divided city as Israel's capital, prompting widespread condemnation. It led to the Palestinian Authority cutting off dialogue with Washington. At the time, the Trump administration said it was strongly committed to achieving a lasting and comprehensive peace in the region. The American embassy was moved from Tel Aviv in May. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Coming up, a spice that needs water. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
This news from VOA Asia. Malaysia has filed criminal charges against Goldman Sachs and two former executives for their role in the alleged multi-billion dollar defrauding of state investment fund 1MDB. Malaysian officials were allegedly bribed into picking the bank to underwrite $6.5 billion in bonds. Goldman Sachs received $600 million in fees. No fee needed to visit VOA Asia Facebook. As VOA Asia continues, saffron is one of the world's most expensive spices. It roughly costs $4,000 for 1 kilogram in India, and it's mainly cultivated in Kashmir. Kashmir is considered one of the three prime locations for saffron farming due to its terrain, soil quality, and weather. However, due to unpredictable changes in climate in the last couple years, saffron production in the Kashmir Valley has been in decline. VOA's Zubair Dar and Yusuf Jamil have more on this as Bejan Hamdard narrates their report.
The long and silky saffron filaments are the three deep red threads of the saffron flower. These are carefully picked from the flower by hand. Each kilogram of saffron is derived from about 150,000 such flowers. Pure saffron sells at high rates in Kashmir, but saffron production has declined in the last 2 years due to severe change in temperature.
There must be at least 3 rainfalls in a year for good saffron yield. This year, we didn't receive even 5% of the rain we normally get. The biggest problem is lack of irrigation. The saffron flower blooms in October through November. It must get plenty of water before that.
Located on the outskirts of the capital, Srinagar, Pampur is the valley's saffron district. Nearly 90% of the cultivation of the exotic purple flower takes place here. It is said that saffron has been growing in the fields of Pampur for close to 2,500 years. Traditionally, Pampur would host a harvest festival after a successful crop season, something the area has not seen in a few years.
In the event of a good crop, a festival would be held here. Everyone would be celebrating and be happy. But the saffron cultivation has suffered enormously during the past 2 to 3 years. You can see beggars take more flowers than I could pluck.
As if that was not enough for the local farmers, Kashmir's saffron is now facing fierce competition in the Indian markets.
Ever since the saffron from overseas reached Indian markets, the Kashmiri produce has lost its demand and grandeur.
Professor A.S. Dar of the Saffron Research Station believes weather is not the only reason why local saffron farmers are seeing a decline in demand.
The main reason is inefficient marketing. The farmers are not getting the price they should get for their produce. Poor rainfall and urbanization of the area have created problems.
Experts say that approximately 120 to 160 kilograms of saffron was being produced per hectare of land in 2005, compared with just 12 kilograms last year. This year, the production may come down even more. For Zubair Dar and Yusuf Jamil in Srinagar, this is Bejan Hamdard, VOA News.
This news from VOA Asia. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said Beijing would guarantee the rights of Canadian detainees are protected after Canadian diplomats gained consular access to the second of two men detained by China in the past week. The detentions are seen as retaliation for Canada's detention of a Huawei executive. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, anyone who has cats knows they're smart. But anyone who knows cats knows they can also seem a bit aloof, at least until dinner time. But don't let them fool you. It turns out your cat is watching you closely. And VOA's Kevin Enix reports they are taking behavioral cues from their humans.
We all know about the ancient and special bond between dogs and humans. Our canine friends can read our tone of voice and our expression, and they look into our eyes for clues that help our two species get along so well. Well, move over, Rover, because it turns out your house cat, far from being the aloof master of the house, can do the same thing.
In general, we found that cats are very good in following human gazing signals.
In experiments, researchers put two exactly alike bowls of food on the floor, but only looked at one. And guess which one the cat went to.
Whether we do a sustained gaze when we don't take off our eyes from the target, or we do a momentary gaze when we just look shortly on the target and then turn back to the cat. So independently of the difficulty or the level of difficulty of these gazing signals, cats are very good in following it.
The question these researchers are asking now, is it just cats and dogs who have learned to do this because they have lived with us for so long? Or is it something that animals just do?
Cats learn spontaneously that where humans look at, it can be important. And this is a very interesting thing, because then you could ask that, okay, if it is not innate but the cats learn it, could any other animal learn it?
This is the only test on this done so far, but the results were clear.
We established whether the given cat performed better than picking randomly. Our results showed that their success rate was 70% overall.
Researchers say one of the reasons it has taken so long to learn about this behavior is because cats are notoriously hard to study. Evidently, they just cannot be bothered. Kevin Enix, VOA News.
Since President John Adams and First Lady Abigail Adams' Christmas party at the White House in December 1800, winter time in the U.S. president's residence has been filled with various holiday festivities. VOA's Patsy Whitaker-Suara tells us this year, First Lady Melania Trump has decked the White House halls in the spirit of the patriotic theme, American Treasures.
It's that time of the year at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. For Melania Trump's second Christmas here, she follows the tradition of First Ladies decking the White House halls.
It was Jacqueline Kennedy who started this tradition of having an annual Blue Room Christmas tree, and that she would pick out a specific theme to base the decoration of that tree, but then also the decorations for the rest of the house. And really since 1961, that's been fairly consistent, and the First Lady has always taken a very prominent role in decorating the house.
This year, Trump chose the patriotic theme American Treasures and featured ornaments that highlight her Be Best anti-bullying campaign. But it was her crimson trees that turned heads and drew mockery online.
We are in 21st century and everybody has a different taste. I think they look fantastic.
3, 2, 1.
It's not the first time Christmas trees became the center of attention.
Merry Christmas, thank you.
As was the norm in the early 1900s, President Theodore Roosevelt did not celebrate with a tree, but his son Archie hid one in the closet.
It sort of became one of these great stories that emerged from the White House that, the press had been waiting. They wanted to know, are the Roosevelts getting a tree? Are they getting a tree? And Archie sort of creates it for them.
Melania Trump did not start the red trend. Cranberry trees have been displayed in the White House since 1975 and have become a consistent feature since the Reagan administration.
Nancy Reagan has always been a fan of red. Her First Lady portrait, she's wearing a red dress. Her state china is in red. So it makes sense that she would be such a strong supporter of that tradition.
The White House end-of-year festivities are rich in tradition that centers around the Christmas tree. From Jackie Kennedy's The Nutcracker Suite, Hillary Clinton's Santa's Workshop, to Melania Trump's American Treasures, each First Lady has celebrated the holiday spirit in her own way. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News at the White House.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. Find us online at VOA Asia Facebook and our website, voanews.com. You'll also find us on the radio, like Falcon Radio at Adamson University in the Philippines. Thanks to everyone there who tuned into our program today. Our thanks as well go out to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Aiden Utku, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team, that's Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're all in Washington. We hope you have a terrific day ahead.